Accession number 28750, Reel 9.
Laurie Manton, Reel 9. If I could ask you a few more questions about this first Gulf War, Laurie, how do you regard the quality and the quantity of the reportage that came out of that? You're in a very good position to know what the journalists were sort of feeding in. And do you think it was well covered? Were radio listeners and television viewers, were they given the full picture, say, of the land war?
Up to a point. I think the bulk of the reporting was done from Saudi Arabia by the thousands of journalists that were based there, who would then receive briefings from the British and the American defence press officers and such like. So they were given a briefing which I would imagine was a particular line that the military wanted to make. They took questions, and then these journalists who were almost like armchair warriors or football pundits for another description, although of course they were under risk of Scud missiles and any chemical attack that would have taken place, but they weren't actually in the war itself. But those that were in the war, certainly on the radio side, from seeing them in operation, Stephen Sacker of the BBC, his reports were particularly brilliantly done, with the simplest of Sony broadcast quality tape recorder. Martin Bell, what reports of his got out were good, although sadly much of his material, filmed interviews and the footage by his cameraman, went round and round the units there until it found its way back to the media centre after the war had ended, by which time it had been overtaken by events. Because at the media centre, which was in the divisional admin area, that's where the material was sent out from, the film footage, the radio interviews and the photographs. They were all sent out from there. Kate Adie was based there, and therefore a lot of her material was reasonably immediate, because that's where the briefings were for the journalists that were attached to the British forces. But unlike the later Gulf War, the second one, they weren't embedded. They were serving with a field force, and indeed they were all issued with an official war correspondence pass with their photo on.
What's the difference between that and being embedded?
Embedded, you're sort of stuck with a unit and can go no further. You're with that unit throughout. And because they feed you and, if you like, clothe you, although your particular media outlet has got to pay for the insurance, pay for the cost of the food and all the rest of it, they, if you like, have a greater personal psychological debt to the people who are looking after them, and there is a danger that it would cause a slight bias in favour of the units that are there. But if you look at the second Gulf War, for example, there was the wounded Iraqi insurgent who was shot by the US Marine, which was filmed by a Canadian cameraman. You know, that's the odd bit where something that took place does actually get out, rather than them keeping quiet about it. And certainly when I come to talk about Bosnia, there were a lot of things that the journalists saw that they never broadcast. But Ken Lennox, for example, at the media centre in the first Gulf War, he would be looking at the photographs and sending them back. And I'm unaware of anything that was censored in the photographic line. But that said, there were limits to the photographic opportunities. Now, the Today photographer, who was probably the most successful of those serving as official war photographers with the British troops, Mike Moore, he actually travelled with the 1st Battalion, the Royal Scots, and as they disembarked their warrior infantry fighting vehicles and rushed across the Iraqi trenches and such, then he was with them. So having analysed all the photographic coverage after the war, looking at all the papers which were kept for me, his in particular stood out. They were the best, if you like, actual battle photographs, and there was nothing really to compare with that.
The other thing that I haven't asked you about, but I think you mentioned in passing as you were talking about something else, was the impact of the oil fires. Could you tell me more about that, what you experienced?
Yes, that was quite interesting, because I saw it from a couple of sides. Having travelled with the DIV admin area across the Kuwaiti border and then lagered up, as they say, they put the vehicles into lagers, create their defensive areas, but it was within sight of the oil fires, and it was pretty amazing, to say the least, because if you stood on the main road that eventually led to Basra and just looked up into the sky, it was the most eerie, continually rolling dark cloud which made it a perpetual dusk. Now, unusually, most people think, gosh, the photos and the film of the vicinities of the oil wells where the fires have been, there's oil everywhere. And indeed, I think it was one of the Telegraph reporters died there when the oil caught fire. And it was like a flash fire that just went along the ground, and even though he got back in his car, there was no way to get out of the flames, and he was killed. But only a short distance away, there seemed to be no oily film going on anything. But there must have been, and there must be some inhalation of the smoke, almost like passive smoking in a way, but probably worse, considering what was being burnt and released by the fires. But I was asked to go and have a look at some areas. And when the oil fires were first set alight, I was taken to an area where people were treating oiled seabirds by the hundreds, and they had a couple of swimming pools which then had netting put over the top of them, like a netted tent to keep the birds in, so they were being cleaned with detergent and then allowed to settle down and rest floating around on these swimming pools. But a lot of the birds did die, because you can clean their feathers, but the trauma of being manhandled plus the oil that they would have ingested meant they were badly affected. But I found that quite shocking, seeing all these birds smothered in oil, which, you know, was a sad reflection on what happened in the oil fields.
Seemed to be, if I remember the images, there was always the image shown of just one bird. And I think the Am I right that the public got a bit sort of sceptical or cynical about that, because it seemed to be this same bird over and over again? But you're saying that really it was a disaster.
Hundreds, thousands of birds were killed like that. I would say, when I was leaving Iraq, I took my empty film containers and filled them with sand as a souvenir. So I've got those. But some months after the war, I bought some material as a collector from a guy who'd been involved in defusing mines and doing mine clearance in the vicinities of the oil field. And for example, he gave me a couple of Iraqi soldiers' dog tags, their identity tags, but they've got almost like tar congealed on them. And he had some sand, but that's like sand on a beach in England when there had been an oil spill. So it was this horrible gooey stuff. You know, years ago, lots of people used to walk on a beach in Devon and then come off with great big black oily sticky stuff on their feet. So undoubtedly it was affected. And I know when they were clearing up, they were skimming off the surface to quite a depth to get these great coverings of oil off.
What did you use in the way of technology for writing your reports while you were in the Gulf?
Well, I used a typewriter because certainly at Soldier we hadn't sort of got to the advances in technology that you have today. A number of the journalists did have sort of early laptops, but they were prone to a number of problems. The sheer amount of dust and sand that was around, plus the impact of them, perhaps finding a generator to plug them into, the generators providing the electric power for the army, plug them into generators, and generators tend to ebb and flow in their power, and suddenly they speed up and there's a huge surge which then burns out the laptop. So perhaps the typewriter was the only way of guaranteeing that you could actually type up some stories. But that in itself, you know, you needed paper, you needed Tipex to cover up the any mistakes, of which are a lot, not like typing on a laptop, because you can correct and even spell check and do all the corrections on screen. But then I'd been taught to type by the army anyway, so you know, and I was taught to type on a typewriter, so it was second nature to me. And indeed, that's my own theory, is that repetitive strain injury, RSI, which affects a lot of writers and people involved in inputting information on computers, as a result of them continually working the keyboard, whereas as a typewriter, when you got to the end of the line, you had to take your hand off, pull across the carriage to return it, and put your hand back. And so you weren't in a fixed position, you were able to move around.
I believe that played a role in the exhibition at the Imperial War Museum.
Yes, it did. They recreated an army 9x9 tent, 9 foot by 9 foot, hence the name 9x9. And in there was sat a journalist in his desert combats with a typewriter on his lap and a dispatch, a story on the liberation of Kuwait, and a nice shemagh, one of the headdress things used as a neck scarf. And it was my typewriter, neck scarf, and one of my original dispatches that was in the typewriter.
And so do you still have that typewriter for use?
No, unfortunately, I lost that when there was a bit of a desire to move quickly in Bosnia. And I had to abandon my typewriter and didn't get reunited with it. So it may well be being used by a Bosnian student now who's come across it. But it's got my name on the case. So.
Well, what was the make of it, out of interest?
Brother.
Oh, that's a very light one, is it?
Yes, I mean, so they were staggering quality, quite light, and about £20. So quite reasonably expendable. But then all the cheap stuff that I was using, for example, my tape recorder was a simple Panasonic cassette recorder, which was just a little handheld thing, a simple plastic mic, and getting great results from this. And the cameras I used were a couple of Minolta X300s, which were dirt cheap manual cameras. And I used Vivitar and Tokina lenses, so I duplicated them. They had a 24-70mm lens and a 70-210. One camera permanently loaded with colour slide, and the other one permanently loaded with black and white film. So mostly I duplicated every shot that I took in colour in black and white. Of course, now with a digital camera, you take a colour shot, you just go into Photoshop, change it to grayscale, and you've got a black and white immediately. It's a big difference. But shooting so much film meant I was starting to carry around bags of film, and unfortunately, just as the ground war was starting, the British Forces post office out there said, well, it's going to be too dangerous, people might post back unexploded grenades as souvenirs to their families and such like, and so they wouldn't accept any more parcels, so I ended up carrying dozens of rolls of film around me, thinking, gosh, I hope I don't lose these because they haven't been developed yet. Whereas, you know, if I'd been shooting digital as one would today, then I'd have three or four little metal and plastic cards which would easily fit into a wallet or something like that. So logistically it was quite different or difficult. What was interesting, using my little Minolta X300s, was that seeing the good journalists like Mike Moore or Ken Lennox from The Sun, or indeed Terry Champion and Mike Weston from Soldier magazine, and they were using electronic cameras, not the digital cameras today, but they were electronic. So if the battery went, they couldn't use them. Whereas the battery went on mine, I didn't have auto exposure because it was a manual camera, but I could operate it because I could change the settings of the lenses to get different exposures manually without any need for power. But all these people's cameras were going down. They were breaking. Because so much dust and sand grains were getting in where the shutter is and in with the film, and it was affecting them, making them break down. And I think certainly if you see any time photographs of Mike Moore's All Singing All Dancing electronic cameras, which were very, very expensive at that time, they were covered in black masking tape to seal off any holes, which is quite ruinous for the cosmetic appearance of the cameras, but it meant then his cameras tended to survive more.
Yes, while we're on this topic, could I ask you a little more about your thoughts about digital, the advantages? Is there a sort of downside to this at all in using a digital camera? You know, you've explained how you can take a film and it can be colour or grey, and I suppose the quantity as well.
Well, I currently use a Fuji camera, a small digital camera, which is about £100, a Fuji F410. Now, this is where most normal people fail when they buy a digital camera because they come with a very small card, and it's to that electronic card that the images are saved. They get a small one, and so they might get 30 photographs, and then they need to get them off the card into their computer and such like. Whereas if you're sensible and buy a large card, and the unit price of those large cards have come right down now. I've got a 512 megabyte card in both my cameras. And in this little Fuji, I can shoot 447 shots before that card is done. Now, again, the majority of the general public are idiotic when it comes to buying conventional film for their cameras. They will go to Boots and they will buy a Fuji Superior 200 ASA colour print film for almost £5. Well, if they'd bought that off the internet or even bothered to look in Amateur Photographer magazine in the back, they could buy that for £1.20 a roll, and that situation has been going on for years. So, you know, people are paying ridiculous prices. But when you're covering a story photographically, the old maxim was film is cheap because you shoot as much as you can, you vary exposure and all the rest of it. But imagine the logistics of shooting 447 shots using conventional film and what you've got to carry around with you and preserve when you've got one small card which is actually smaller than 1 inch by 1 inch and about an eighth of an inch thick. There's a big difference in what you've got to move around. Now, there are difficulties. You could lose the card. Therefore, they make nice big plastic and padded boxes, which are much more difficult to lose. And they're brightly coloured, so you put the cards in there, they're protected. You put it in your computer, and you print off whichever ones you want. You can also manipulate the images on the computer a lot easier. Make colour photographs into black and whites. You can't do it the other way around. But if you're shooting everything in colour first, and do what you want. Archivally, this is a real problem for history, because so many photographs are remaining in computers or on CD-ROMs and never actually being printed. And it's not like, you know, a carefully filed contact sheet of 36 black and white exposures from one film with the negatives filed in strips behind. This is a chunk of electronic images, and it's quite easy not to, for example, if you use the wrong paper, then exposure to the light of that photograph you've printed on your printer, and the quality of those printers is now superb and cheap to produce. Get the wrong paper, within a few years they've already started fading, which normal photographic prints didn't. So you need to get the archival paper, which is, you know, they guarantee the light fastness of the image for anything up to 100 years, which is better. But it might be in 50 years' time that no one has any technology to deal with what were the early types of digital film cards. And if you think they're already talking about this week in the national papers that because so many people are downloading songs from the internet, that there'll be a time fairly soon when people won't buy their music as CDs in the shops. Their DVD came along and started saving more than CD-ROMs. So it won't be long before CDs go out of fashion, in the same way as if you've got an old computer, you can use a floppy disk, which ridiculously at the time, you thought this is wonderful. It stores lots of words, but not many photos. And computers produced now don't have floppy disk slots. You have to go and buy a little thing that you plug in with a USB plug into your computer to be able to download material from disk. So disks are very much on their way out. The CDs will be next. There's talk already over the last few months of something that will replace DVD as well. There's no standard. And you think on the front of my personal computer at home, which 15 months ago was the, if you like, the top model. It was the fastest going. And it had the most number of sockets on the front in which to put all the different types of photo card from these digital cameras. Now, it's ridiculous. Canon uses a compact flash card, and most professional cameras do, which is an inch by an inch. Fuji use an XD card, which is half an inch by half an inch. Sony use a memory stick, which is like a long stick, lollipop stick that you stick in another socket. You know, why was there no standard? So everyone just uses the same socket. It's all very peculiar. But, you know, ignoring all these difficulties and the need to archive your stuff, burn it off on CD-ROM or DVD, because if your computer blows up, you've a real problem. You've lost all your images. And in my case, I burn two CDs or DVDs every time. You know, one on my shelf that I can work from, and the other is stored somewhere else. So hopefully I don't lose it. But it's the sheer ease of taking the photographs and the number you can take with your little camera, 36 exposure as opposed to 447.
So I suppose really it's a most wonderful historical potential here, isn't there? It's, you know, for everyday life or war, all the different images you get, but you've just got to make sure that it's stored in the technology that can download it. Is that right?
Yeah.
Or you print out enough of the really important ones to signpost what you've done.
Because I found a box of rough black and white prints from 1991 after the war of some of the war scenes that I shot on there, tucked away in the box, proper photographic prints. And they're perfect, like they've just been done, but some of the early stuff that was printed off on these computer printers have already badly faded. But if you look at what I shot in the Gulf War, which was 3,500 colour slides, that's 100 rolls of 36 exposure film, and that's a lot to carry around on 7 1-inch by 1-inch, eighth of an inch deep cards, which take up a fraction of that space. I could have contained all those that I shot over the whole Gulf War period.
What a difference. The pace that this has happened, you know, it's such a short period from what you're saying, that all this is happening, and probably in the future will be even quicker.
Well, you've only got to look at the fact that, you know, someone like Ilford, who sold all the black and white film, went bust because there's not the imagery. I think it's Dixon's have stopped selling conventional cameras in the same way that they've stopped selling or they're just about to stop selling video recorders. Now, a lot of people would have transferred film of the Gulf War onto videotapes, and suddenly they'll have trouble finding something to play it, so they need to transfer it to DVD. The DVD will get replaced. But there's a marvellous thing at the moment being advertised in all the quality papers over the last month or so, and this is this little machine that's a DVD player and a video player, but you can record your videotapes onto DVD. It's about £200, and that's a quick way of doing all your switching things over to modern technology. So I think that's a good development, having something like that, instead of having to pay tens or hundreds of pounds to get one of these specialist companies to dub off your video footage.
End of Reel 9, Laurie Manton.